I normally don't get nervous when I do these podcast interviews, but this one had me on pins and needles. I had a chance to interview Bob Metcalf. Bob is the inventor of Ethernet, the founder of 3Com, and one of my early technology heroes. As is the normal outcome of these interviews, we covered a wide range of topics, including the role of industry standards, the invention of Ethernet, the founding of 3Com, Bob's view of the future of networking, the true history of Metcalf's Law, advice to entrepreneurs, and Bob's current interest in energy. This podcast was recorded via Skype, so I do apologize for the audio quality. Enjoy.
This is the Killer Innovations Podcast with Phil McKinney. Keep in mind that the information and opinions expressed in this podcast are Phil's and Phil's alone, and they don't necessarily reflect those of his past, current, or future employers. Now, here's Phil McKinney.
Talk a little bit about your early days when you were at Xerox PARC, when you originally were working on kind of the whole networking thought process there. Take us back there to a little bit about what was the catalyst that got you thinking about the issues of networking and then ultimately led to the work that ultimately spun out to become 3Com.
My involvement in networking, and particularly the ARPANET, goes before Xerox PARC, back to Harvard and MIT. When I became a grad student at Harvard, it was easy for me to choose the ARPANET as my graduate work, because that was what the DARPA, or ARPA as it was called then, was heavily promoting. So I became a grad student working on the ARPANET, and then I had a falling out with Harvard, and so I did all my work at MIT, what was then called MIT Project MAC, and built a high-speed network interface there between a PDP-10, then the popular time-sharing machine, and the my own IMP. I had an ARPANET IMP that I was responsible for, and I built hardware to connect them. And that high-speed interface was sort of my entry into the high-speed networking interface business. And then when I went on to Xerox PARC, my first assignment was to do it again, which was to connect Xerox into the ARPANET.
So take us back also. When you say high-speed, what was high-speed at the time?
300 kilobits per second was the peak speed between, now that was between the PDP-10 and the IMP. In our actual data transmissions, we rarely exceeded 15 kilobits per second.
It's amazing how times change, huh, with scale.
And there's a story about that, speaking of funny, which is that this IMP I mentioned switched packets from the PDP-10 there on the ninth floor of Tech Square here in Cambridge to a bunch of other universities, and each month we had to report the traffic, say the number of packets from MIT to Harvard or MIT to Stanford or MIT to UCLA, et cetera. And the biggest number on the page was the number of packets that went from MIT to MIT. and that was embarrassing. We referred to that as incestuous traffic, and we didn't report it to ARPA because it was embarrassing, because that wasn't the purpose of the ARPANET. Of course, only a few years later, all that so-called incestuous traffic has become known as LAN traffic, and was, of course, most of the traffic on networks these days.
So your project at Xerox PARC then was, you know, basically do it again. And so what were you working on there? What you were trying to do, what, the stars, connecting the star machines there at PARC, or?
Oh, no, this is way before that.
Okay.
So this was starting in 1972.
Oh, okay.
And the first, Xerox PARC had done is we built a clone of PDP-10. We built our own PDP-10, and my job was to connect it into the ARPANET. So I built another so-called high-speed network interface to connect the MAX, was called MAXC, which was a PDP-10 clone, into the ARPANET so that it would be connected. And then after that, we began work on what is arguably the first personal computer, or early one, called the Alto. And then it was my job to network all the Altos together, one on each desk, the first time probably in history that a building was to be filled with PCs, one per desk.
And so what was the architecture of those early systems compared to, you know, as you progressed? I mean, obviously it was different than what you did at MIT. So what were the lessons learned and what were the steps of improvement that you were working on?
Well, the first impulse was to recreate the ARPANET inside the building. But we quickly concluded that that was too complicated, too much, you know, too many moving parts. And so we ran across the Aloha Packet Network at the University of Hawaii and used that as a model. So we strung a coaxial cable down the hall and put drop cables from that coax down into each office. And then the attached PCs in each office would then send their packets up into the ether, up into this cable, and they would propagate all over the place, and hence the name Ethernet.
So yeah, so the Aloha Network has always been referenced as kind of the catalyst, or at least kind of the early reference design. So what's the history on the Aloha Network? How did that come about?
Well, actually, there were two. I say the ARPANET and the Aloha Network were equal parents in the Ethernet. And the Aloha Network was developed by Norm Abramson at the University of Hawaii. And his purpose was connecting a bunch of dumb terminals, to an IBM 360 mainframe at the University of Hawaii Manoa campus. And the dumb terminals, the users of the dumb terminals would type in what amounted to a card image, punched card image, and press send, and then the terminal, a radio, would via radio send that card image up to the 360, and if it didn't receive an acknowledgement soon, it would try again, and of course it would try again by randomizing. It would, to avoid repeated interferences in this channel it was using, it would randomize its retransmissions, and that was the key idea that we brought into Ethernet.
So you're at Xerox, you're working on what effectively then becomes Ethernet. What's the decision? I mean, a lot of listeners to the podcast always struggle with the fact that they're inside the large corporation, they're working on an idea, and you know, what becomes the catalyst or the impetus to finally let go of the safety net of a large corporate entity and actually, you know, go out on your own? You know, you leave Xerox and founded 3Com.
Well, I was at Xerox for 8 years, half the time in research and half the time in systems development. And this is not in Xerox Rochester, but Xerox Silicon Valley. So I was surrounded by guys like Bill and Dave, who had started a company called HP, and Bob Noyce, who had started a company called Intel, and Steve Jobs, who had started a company called Apple, et cetera. So it was in the water that you should go out and start a company. So after 8 years at Xerox, I departed amicably, wanting to pursue entrepreneurial interests. At the time, I didn't know what those would be. So I became a consultant, and in the early months of 1979, here at MIT, in fact, I commuted between Palo Alto and Boston for the summer of 79, and it was in that period that we decided to make Ethernet a standard, and I decided to build a company around that standard.
So the decision was to do the standard first and then build the company around the standard?
Yes, I was consulting to Gordon Bell, who was then Vice President of Research of DEC, Vice President of Engineering at DEC. And he asked me to devise a LAN much like Ethernet, because he admired it. But I told him I had only recently left Xerox. I didn't feel comfortable doing that. And then we had the idea, wait a minute, why don't we just work with Xerox and have DEC and Xerox work together on Ethernet? So I drafted a letter for Gordon, which he sent to Xerox. And Xerox said, sure, why don't we do that? And then later we found Intel, who was hot to make a chip and looking for applications, and we brought them into the fold. So by June of 79, we had Xerox, DEC, and Intel preparing to work together to make an industry standard called Ethernet. So on June 4th, I started 3Com, June 4th of 79, in order to serve what I imagined to be a large market created by this three-company standard.
So it's interesting, because you would think that you had something at Xerox, but actually going out and getting the standards and getting that ecosystem going actually became almost a required catalyst to really make Ethernet viable then.
I think so. I think that the idea of getting Ethernet to be non-proprietary, which was necessary in order for DEC Intel and Xerox to pursue it jointly, that in fact, it became so necessary that in December of that year, we worked to create IEEE Project 802 in order to standardize Ethernet in the normal open processes of IEEE. And in fact, just this week, IEEE Project 802 is celebrating its 30th anniversary, and that's an anniversary of an effort that began with wanting to standardize Ethernet and, of course, has blossomed in the intervening 30 years.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's 30 years. It's hard to think back to life before what we all have on our desks today.
That's right. The world looks different from here than it did from there, and it's very hard to go back. For example, I have to explain to my children that we had electronics in our dorm rooms too, but they were stereo systems as opposed to personal computers. My kids just can't imagine what the world would be like without personal computers and iPods and things, but that's how it was. So when I got the job of networking those Alto computers at Xerox Research, that was great luck. That was the first time anyone had been given the problem of networking personal computers, one on every desk. And so so my good fortune to get that problem, and then out of it came Ethernet.
So when you were back starting 3COM and the 802 standards activities are underway, did you have any inkling of the impact that that effort was going to have on just the way people operate today?
Well, in a way, well, by that time, I'd had the advantage of living in a time machine. I lived at the Xerox Palo Alto Research Center, which was sort of is a very famous place to have been in those days. And we were allowed to live in the future. So we put PCs on every desk. We built early laser printers. We connected to the internet. We had mice. We had bitmap displays. We had removable storage. We had all those things that no one else had. And we lived that way for 10 years, in my case, 8 years. And so when we left and went out into the real world, we sort of knew what the world was, we thought we knew what the world was going to look like. And of course, we happened to be right, because now the PCs that we all use very much resemble what had been in our time machine there at Xerox. So then in developing the, in my case, developing the Ethernet, I had an advantage over all my competitors because I had a vision of what the future would be like, and that vision was, of course, just simply what I had experienced at Xerox PARC.
Yeah, I mean, it's always hard when you look back and try to think about what has, you know, what the transformation. I mean, as I was sharing with you before we started the recording, you know, I back in 83, I actually deployed a 3COM EtherShare infrastructure, 15 nodes in Chicago, bringing that in and installing that and allowing people to see that little glimpse of the future, change that entire organization about how you think about productivity, the benefit of collaboration, the ease of sharing of information. I remember the first deployment of Ethermail, and it just rocked people's world from the standpoint of not being dependent on the old traditional mainframe dumb terminal, but that you could share the computing platform on your desk. And then you think about what that is to what it is today, where, you know, like you said, our kids, you know, my youngest is a senior in college, and last summer we were cleaning out the garage, and I came across a bunch of old IBM mainframe punch cards from a program I wrote in college, and I had to spend 20 minutes explaining to him what a punch card was.
Yeah. Well, if you go back in time, remember that in 1982, IBM introduced the IBM PC XT, whose principal feature was a 10-megabyte disk. And no one could imagine what you would use a 10-megabyte disk for on a PC. So that's where Ethernet came in. So in the early use of Ethernet was to share that 10-megabyte disk among a work group full of PCs. And in 84, you may remember, Apple came out with its laser printer, which a leading printer was sort of modeled on what we'd done at Xerox. And it cost $7,000. So once again, the Ethernet was useful for printer sharing. And then it was later that mail kicked off, like ether mail. There were two kinds of email in those days. There was the kind sent by TimeNet and AOL and the big long-haul carriers, and it cost maybe a buck a message. And then there was land mail, and I once was on a panel where I added up all the lands we sold, and we were selling, you know, we were carrying 100 times more messages than the long-haul email carriers, and we were doing so at a fraction of a cent of amortized cost. Of course, now land mail and long-distance mail have merged. They're now, of course, the same thing.
And like I said, mail for me was the real eye-opener on the ability just within an organization. And now, like today, I'm sitting here and my phone is vibrating on the desk, telling me that I've got yet one more email that's going unread in my mailbox. And so we could all blame you for the constant flow now of the being able to bring that to my desktop.
I won't take exclusive credit for that, but I.
So talk a little about, you know, there's a famous law, Metcalfe's law, about the value of the network. So talk a little bit about Metcalfe's law and how you think, what do you think the future with Metcalfe's law is going to be? And when you think about, you know, now with the global scale and, you know, connectivity reaching to a much broader audience than even just what happens inside of an organization or even inside of a country.
Well, in order to sell Ethernet into small PC work groups, we devised a starter kit of three Ethernet adapters that you would plug into your PCs and then the software that would run on them, including Ethermail. And that worked. A lot of people were willing to build a three-node network to see what it would do. But after about a year, we went back to those people to try to sell them more, and they said, well, this network does everything you said it would do, but it's not very useful. So I had to come up with a way of explaining why the network wasn't useful yet. And that led to a slide in which I theorized that there was a critical mass point you had to reach before your network was paying for itself. And I calculated that crossover point by a straight line indicating the cost, which went up linearly with the number of nodes. But a quadratic, which was sort of the number of nodes you could talk to times the number of nodes, or n squared, and the quadratic crosses the linear at some point, and that's the critical mass point. And so then we went out to our customers and we said, the reason your network isn't as useful as you'd like is it isn't big enough, so you need to buy 30 more nodes from us. and they believed us. And they did. And the networks turned out to be useful, as you've just testified. And so that was when the Ethernet really started taking off. Well, anyway, that slide showing the critical mass point in 1993, quite a bit later, was named Metcalfe's Law. And I've been defending it ever since. The value of a network grows as the square of its number of participants. And it's kind of fun. That law, Metcalfe's Law, is... I like to say the only thing it has in common with Moore's Law is that it starts with M, in that Moore's Law has actually been mathematically true since 1965, whereas Metcalfe's Law has never actually been numerically evaluated. It's sort of a vision law, Metcalfe's Law. But it is a vague attempt to say that there is a network effect, and the network effect is surprising. That is, in my case, I've suggested it's quadratic. But but there's been a lot of debate about whether it really is quadratic, and is there some point in which the curve stops going up and starts turning down, which I think is a respectable theory. Anyway, I'm standing by Metcalfe's Law, and I believe it's exactly correct, and I defend it against all comers. And every once in a while, somebody attacks it as being inaccurate, and they're probably right, but I defend it anyway.
So 3Com gets started. It was one of the hot companies here in the Valley. It turns into being a big success. You leave 3Com in, what, 1990? Is that right?
Yeah, we started in June of 79, and I retired in January of 90. I say retired, that I left the company and tried to retire, and that lasted 6 months.
So what have you been doing after 3Com now?
Well, right after 3Com, I became a visiting fellow at Cambridge University in England, and that was my effort to to retire. But after a year, I got stir crazy, so I took a job as publisher of InfoWorld, the personal computer industry magazine, and did that for some years and began writing a column for it. So for about 10 years, I was a pundit from 1990 to 2000, writing columns and becoming VP Technology for International Data Group, which is the publisher of 300 magazines, including InfoWorld. So then after organizing conferences and writing my weekly column in 2001, I then switched and became a venture capitalist. And I've been a venture capitalist for the last nine and some years.
So what do you miss most about doing the startup thing? Or do you miss doing the 3Com experience of starting something that turns into being something as big and as significant as 3Com has been in the industry?
Well, the life of a venture capitalist is quite different from that of being in a company. We have a portfolio we're responsible for, and you can't really get your hands on things as a board member, generally. In fact, it's bad if you do. So one of the things I occasionally miss is being part of a tight-knit team with a focused goal and building a company. I occasionally miss that. And on occasion, a couple of occasions, I've succumbed to it and become the CEO, interim CEO of one of our portfolio. I've done it twice now to become interim CEO of one of our portfolio companies. That generally is not a good sign for the company. But that is the difference. Is this? I miss the camaraderie of the team building the company and fighting the battles and evangelizing the products and figuring out how to build them better and market them better and manufacture them better. You have to do everything better. So I miss that a little bit.
So now you've got a little bit of time. You've got a lot of time. So you left in 1990. You've got 20 years of being gone from 3Com. If you look back, would there have been things you would have done differently when you started 3Com? Is there things that you said, well, if I only knew this, you would do something differently?
Well, that's a dangerous hypothetical exercise. Things worked out so good for me that I wouldn't change anything for fear that it would, spoil the whole situation.
Mm-hmm.
But, it did work out very well. I guess if I had one regret, it would be that in 1980 or 81, the IBM Corporation invited me twice and paid me $2,000 each time for a one-day shot, once in the Office Systems Division in New Jersey and once in Research Triangle Park, to present Ethernet to IBM and as part of their decision process for deciding what to do. And after those two shots, being not a very good salesman and being more of a arguer, sort of an obnoxious New Yorker who argues, I didn't get the order. I failed to convince IBM to adopt the Ethernet standard, and so they went off on this IBM token ring thing, and then, which lasted another 25 years. So I guess I regret not being a better salesman early in my career. I got better at sales later, but not when I had those two shots at IBM in the early 80s.
You look at all the players that are now in the networking space, with the Ciscos of the world, and actually now with this big consolidation that's happening in the space. Obviously, there's been a lot of companies who've gone off and said, hey, there's these standards, or we want to drive these kinds of standards to go off and compete also in this networking space. What do you think the future looks like in the networking space relative to everything that's going on right now? There's just, a huge amount of activities. Networking is becoming the hot topic, whether it be in the telco carriers or Google now doing fiber optic to city tests, et cetera. If you had to put your crystal ball in front of you, what does the future look like?
I've been thinking about that, but I have a particular point of view. I'm a plumber. I'm an internet plumber. Very levels 1, 2, 3, 4 maybe. So, but my view looks like this. It's imagine a 3x3 matrix. That's my picture of the future. And on the vertical axis are the new modes of traffic which are invading the internet. And those modes are video, mobile, and embedded. And then across the top, the three columns, are the new application areas where the internet is expected to disrupt. And those are energy, healthcare, and education. And so the opportunities that I'm looking for in the future of the internet are in that 3x3, in those 9 spaces. That is, how can we use video in education? How can we use embedded networking in energy? How can we use, how will mobile affect healthcare? In other words, do you see what I
oh, yeah.
mean by that 3x3?
Yeah, no, I got it. Explain a little bit about what you mean by embedded.
Embedded is the 10 billion microcontrollers that are shipped every year already, about 10 billion. And very few of those are networked. And we need to get them networked into all their devices. It'll make them, by Metcalfe's law, it will make them much more valuable if they are networked. So you imagine sensor networks for energy management. Take those embedded controllers and lights and thermostats and smart meters and network them together so they can better manage networks, manage energy. You can imagine putting networked microcontrollers and all sorts of health monitors, on-body health monitors, so we can better do health care, you could imagine, and so on. So embedded, the networking of embedded microcontrollers
okay.
is what I mean by embedded. Well, those embedded machines are going to generate a lot of traffic. They may be, for example, the occasion for finally moving to IP version 6. We've been using version 4 all these years. But there are going to be so many of these embedded controllers, already 10 billion, but it's going to go up and up and up, that we that's a lot of traffic come and a new kind of traffic, just like video is. Well, video we're still incorporating into the internet. Mobile traffic, we're in the midst of putting on the internet. Next comes embedded, which we're now beginning to put on the internet. Those are three different new kinds of traffic that will require the internet's plumbing to be updated and improved and perhaps even redesigned.
So recently it was announced HP is going to acquire 3Com. Thoughts? Advice to HP?
Lots. I mean, 3Com was founded on the in the shadow of HP, and when it came time, and many of our people were HP graduates, and when in our early day, when we were thrashing around for culture, you know, what the company should be like inside, we immediately adopted the HP way as our corporate culture. So it's poetic that 30 years later HP and 3Com should combine. Now, I have a certain way of looking. You know, I haven't been at 3Com since 1990, so it's not as if I'm being merged in or anything. But I like to think of it this way. Now that 3Com's part of HP, that means that Bill, Dave, and I are the co-founders of HP. Don't you think that'll fly?
Well, I'll talk to corporate about getting your picture hung next to Bill and Dave's picture in the corporate headquarters in Palo Alto.
Well, anyway, I'm very proud that my company was good enough to be incorporated into HP, which is, of course, very famous and a much admired company. So I'm delighted. I could think of some worse companies that would acquire 3Com, and I'm so happy that it was HP.
So what? Some of the listeners of the podcast are kids that are in high school, going into college, or kids that are kind of in college trying to figure out what they're going to do once they graduate. And one of the common interests or one of the common emails I get is, hey, you know, I want to be an entrepreneur. I've got great ideas. What is it, you know, they're asking for advice about what classes should I take? What should my major be if I want to be an innovator? So if you're giving career advice to a high school, college age person who's thinking about wanting to be an entrepreneur and start businesses, what would be the career advice you'd give them?
Well, I don't think you set out to be abstractly an innovator. You start out in a field that you enjoy and that you develop expertise in, and then you innovate in that field. So I wouldn't have any recommendations about courses to be an innovator, but I would urge people to find something they like to do and be enthusiastic about, and then pay attention to where that field is going and what problems it faces. And then I guess there's another lesson, which is you can learn to be an innovator on purpose. Going back to the old question, are entrepreneurs or innovators, are they born or are they made? And I think they're made. In other words, I went to Silicon Valley and was surrounded by Bill and Dave and Steve and Bob Noyce and so on. So they were role models, and they showed how to be an entrepreneur and an innovator. So you can be an innovator and entrepreneur on purpose. It's not in your genes. It's in the environment. So I think learning a field that you love comes ahead of being an entrepreneur and innovator. You don't. I'm a little confused by people who say, "I want to start a company, any company. Tell me what to do." I rather like the Steve Jobs model. He started Apple because he had something he wanted to accomplish. He wanted to make insanely great personal computers, and starting a company was a means to an end. It wasn't the end.
Mm-hmm.
And I started 3Com to pursue the propagation of Ethernet, the Ethernet standard. That was my. It wasn't so much to start a company as to use. It was the company's job was going to be to project Ethernet. So I guess I'm saying have something big you want to do first, practice being an innovator, and then go for it.
So what's next for Bob Metcalf? You're a venture capitalist now. You're helping companies get off the ground and get going. What's the next chapter in Bob Metcalf's life?
Well, I've got 6 companies that I'm currently in charge of or working on behalf of my partnership, Polaris. And so I got 6 next chapters, which is those companies about which I care a lot and am working hard to advance. I lost 2 companies last summer. It was really horrible. I don't want to do that. So I'm pretty much focused on getting these 6 companies to flourish and grow. And I'll probably add some more to the portfolio over time. Those are my next chapters.
And so what areas of interest are you pursuing from the standpoint of your venture investing? Are there particular areas that you find particularly interesting that you're looking at or involved in?
Oh, yes. I was an internet tycoon, but now I'm interested in solving energy. So I sort of view the solution of energy as the next big thing. Not that we're done building the internet. We still have a long way to go, as I sketched earlier. But personally, I've begun looking at the problem of solving energy, providing an abundance, a squanderable abundance of cheap and clean energy for the world. And so 5 of my 6 companies are energy companies, energy technology companies. I call them Enertech companies.
So is that to develop the creation of clean energy, energy efficiencies, energy distribution, or all of the above?
All of the above.
Okay.
So actually, the three we're doing in my group of 5 5 energy companies. There's energy storage, so far, solar generation, and energy efficiency would be the 3 categories. But energy is a very broad field, and we're a diversified venture capital firm. So I would expect to diversify. We're looking for wind investments. We're looking for nuclear investments. We're looking for further storage, further smart grid investments. So just the various aspects of solving energy.
The real background and purpose of the Heritage of Innovation series is there's a lot of people out there who are interested in technologies and innovations, but in some cases, we've lost the stories. We lose the history of what was really happening at the time, what was really the underlying catalyst that caused, for instance, Bill and Dave in the garage, or the guys going from Fairchild to start Intel, you leaving Xerox to start 3Com. And so part of my objective in this is to kind of capture a little bit of that oral history.
Every time I drive through the intersection of El Camino and Page Mill, I know that Bill and Dave's garage is right there.
Mm-hmm.
I have a sense of, I imagine what it was like for them in the early days of their entrepreneurship in that little garage. Now, I didn't start in a garage. I started in a dining room in Oak Creek Apartments on Sand Hill Road in 1979. not quite a garage because I had a swimming pool downstairs. But it's the same idea. I mean, it was a dining room after all, and my mother was worried that I had foolishly left Xerox, a good job at Xerox, to do this iffy thing. But it really wasn't that iffy. Technological innovation is a very high calling, and people are rooting for you when you do it. And it makes the world go round. So I'm a big fan of entrepreneurs. In fact, that's sort of my first love are entrepreneurs and finding and encouraging them and helping them.
And I thank you again for your time, and we'll talk to you real soon.
You're welcome. I look forward to hearing the podcast.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
This series of interviews with innovation thought leaders is made possible by support from thenextbench.com. For more information on the series and to listen to the previous episodes, visit thenextbench.com.
Thanks for listening to this week's podcast. Please send your feedback, questions, and suggestions for future shows to podcast@kitinnovations.com. Stay connected over at LinkedIn and over at Facebook. Send your invite to podcast@kitinnovations.com. Please note in the invite that you are a regular listener to the podcast. Also, follow over on Twitter @PhilMcKinney. The Best of the Killer Innovations podcast is now available on CD. You can order over at Amazon if you live within the U.S., or visit PhilMcKinney.com to order your CD if you live outside of the U.S. Thanks for taking the time out of your busy schedule to listen. Talk to you real soon. Bye-bye.